From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Cocoon by John B. L. Goodwin. Whereas downstairs his father had a room, the walls of which were studded with trophies of his aggressive quests, heads of ibex, chamois, eland, Kate Loa, Pecorari, and Ounce, upstairs Denny had pinned upon his playroom walls the fragile bodies of swallowtails, nymphs, fritillaries, meadow browns, and angel wings. Although his father had maneuvered expeditions, experienced privation, waded through jungles, climbed upon crags for his specimens, Denny had blithely gathered his within the fields and gardens close to home. It was likely that his father's day as a collector was over. Denny's has just begun. Denny was 11 and his father 46, and the house in which they lived was 100 or more years old, though no one could be exact about it. Mr. Petey Bog, the postmaster in the shriveled village, said as how he could recall when the circular window on the second story landing hadn't been there, and Mrs. Bliss said she knew that at one time what was now the kitchen had been a tap room because her father had told her about it. The heart of the house, as Denny's father put it, was very old, but people had altered it and added on and covered up. Denny's father had added the room where his heads were hung. But Denny's playroom must have been the original attic, because where the rafters of its high, abrupt ceiling were visible, the nails in them were square-headed, and here and there the timbers were still held together with wooden pegs. But the playroom where Danny also slept appeared to the casual glance anything but old. The floor was carpeted in blue, and curtains were yellow, and the bedspread blue and white. The wallpaper, which his mother had chosen for him before she left, was yellow willow trees on a pale blue ground, and to an alien eye the butterflies pinned on the walls seemed part of the design. It had been a long time since Denny's father had been up in the room, and although he knew that his son's collection of Lepidoptera, as he called them, was pinned upon the wall, he did not know, and therefore could not reprimand his son for the damage they had done the pretty wallpaper. Under each specimen, a putty-colored blot was spreading over the blue paper. It was the oil exuding from the drying bodies of the dead insects. In one corner of the room was a chintz-covered chest in which lay the remains of Denny's earlier loaves, battered trains and sections of track, an old transformer, batteries covered with cavern-like crystals of zinc salt, trucks and windmills, no longer recognizable as much more than haphazard, wooden arrangements of fitted blocks and sticks, books crumpled and torn, with Denny's name or current dreams scrawled aggressively in crayon across the print and pictures, a gyroscope, a rubber ball, its cracked paint making a mosaic of antique red and gold around its sphere, and somewhere at the bottom, weighed down with tin and lead and wood, more than any corpse with earth and grass, lay a bear, a monkey, and a boy doll with a scar across one cheek, where Denny had kicked it with a skate. In another corner, the symbols of his present were proudly displayed. The butterfly net leaned against the wall, and close to the floor in a wooden box, turned upside down, stood Denny's cyanide bottle, tweezers and pins, the last shining as dangerously bright as minute surgical instruments in their packet of black paper. After almost a year of collecting butterflies, Denny had found that a certain equivocable quality could be added to his pursuit if he were to collect not only the butterflies, but also the earlier stages of their mutations. By cramming milk bottles, shoe boxes, and whatever other receptacle the house might offer with caterpillars and pupae, he was, in the case of those that survived, able to participate in a sort of alchemy. Intently, he would squat on his haunches and gaze into the receptacles, studying the laborious transformations. The caterpillar, shedding skin. The exudation that is used to hitch its shroud-like chrysalid to twigs or undersides of leaves, and then the final unpredictable attainment of the imago. It was like opening a surprise package, for as yet Denny had not learned to tell what color, size, or shape worm would turn into a dog's head sulfur, morning cloak, or tiger swallowtail. As late summer approached, Denny insisted that the servant girl refrain from opening the windows wide in order to air out his room. The sudden change in temperature, he said, would disturb the caterpillars and pupae. Even though the girl reported to his father that Denny's room smelled unhealthily from all the bugs and things, the man did no more than mention it to Denny in an offhand manner. Denny grunted to show that he had heard, and did no more about it. And as his father was writing a book on his jungles and crags and beasts, he had really very little concern about what went on upstairs. So it was that an acrid smell of decaying vegetable matter, resolving itself into insect flesh, pervaded Denny's bright attic room, and the oily blotches on the walls beneath the specimens spread over, so slightly discoloring the paper more and more. In a book, Butterflies You Ought to Know Better, which an aunt had sent him for Christmas, Denny read that a suitable castle for a caterpillar could be made by placing a lamp chimney closed at the top upon a flower pot filled with earth. He prepared this enclosure, purchasing the lamp chimney from the village store with his own money. It was such an elegant contrivance, and yet so magical, that he decided to save it for an especially unusual specimen. It was not until a late afternoon in October that Denny found one worthy of the castle. He was exploring a copse between two fields. Because of the stoniness of its ground, it had never been cultivated and lay like a sword between the fertility of the fields on either side. Denny had never trespassed on it before, and dared to now only because of his growing self-confidence in his power over nature. A month ago, he would have shied away from the area entirely, even taking the precaution to circumvent the two fields enclosing it. But he felt a little now the way he thought God must feel when, abject within its glass and cardboard world, the life he watched took form, changed, and ceased. Protected from unpleasant touch or any unpredictable action, then he watched the metamorphosis from worm to chrysalid to miraculously vibrant petal. It lay within his power to sever abruptly the magical chain of their evolution at any point he chose. In a little way, he was a little like God. It was this conceit that now gave him the courage to climb over the stones of the old wall and enter the half acre of dense woodland. The autumn sun, already low, ogled the brittle landscape, like some improbable jack-o'-lantern hanging in the west. What birds were still in that country spoke in the rasping tone of the herd. The more mellifluous and prosperous had already gone south. Although the leaves on the trees displayed the incautious yellows of senility and osiers of decay, the underbrush, such as campbrier and wild grape, were mostly green. Armed with his forceps and his omnipotence, Denny explored each living leaf and twig. Brambles tore his stockings and scratched his knees, but except for vulgar tent caterpillars and the wild cherry trees, Denny's efforts went unrewarded. It was dusk when, scratching among the speculatively shaped leaves of a sassafras, Denny found the specimen beyond his most arrogant expectations. At first sight, due in part to the twilight, it looked more like some shriveled dragon than a caterpillar. Between it and the twig, a filament stretched, and this, added to the fact that when Danny touched it gingerly, he could feel its puffy flesh contract the way caterpillars do, convinced him that it was no freak of nature, or if it was a caterpillar freak, and therefore nothing to fear. Tearing it cautiously with his tweezers from the twig, he put the monster in the diamond matchbox he always carried with him, and running breathlessly, blind to briar and brambles, Denny headed home. It was supper time when he got home, and his father was already at the table, his left hand turning the pages of a book, while with his right hand he ladled soup into his mouth. Denny had clattered up the stairs before his father was aware of his presence. "You're late, son," he said in the moment between two printed sentences and two spoonfuls of soup. "I know, father," Denny replied without stopping, "but I got something." Another sentence and another spoonful. "How many times have I told you to be explicit? Something can be anything from a captive balloon to a case of mumps." From the second landing, Denny called down, "It's just something. I don't know what it is." His father mumbled, and by the time he had finished a paragraph and scooped up the last nugget of meat out of his soup and had addressed his son with the words, "Whatever it is, we'll wait until you have your supper," then he was peering at it through the glass of the lamp chimney. Even in the bright electric glare, it was reptilian. It was large for a caterpillar, between 4 and 5 inches long. Denny guessed, and was made a muddy purple color, its underside a yellowish black. At either extremity it bore a series of 3 horny protuberances of a vermilion shade. They were curved sharply inward, and stiff little hairs grew from them. From its mouth there protruded a set of small grasping claws, like those of a crustacean. Its skin was wrinkled like that of a tortoise, and the abdominal segments were sharply defined. The feet lacked the usual suction-like apparatuses caterpillars have, but were scaly and shaped like tiny claws. It was indeed worthy of its castle. It was not to be found in any of the illustrated books Denny had. He would guard it and keep it a secret, and finally, when he presented its metamorphosis into a winged thing to the world, his father's renown as the captor of extraordinary beasts would pale beside his own. The only thing he could guess at, and that because of its size, was that it was a larva of a moth rather than that of a butterfly. He was still peering at it when the servant girl brought up a tray. "Here," she said, "if you're such a busy little gentleman that you can't spare time for supper like an ordinary boy. If I had my way, you'd go hungry." She set the tray down on the table. "Oh," she added, "the smell of this room is something awful. What have you got there now?" And she was about to peer over Danny's shoulder. "Get out," he shrieked, turning to her. "Get out." "I'm not so sure I will if you speak like that." He arose and in his fury pushed her hulk out the door, slamming it and locking it after her. She started to say something on the other side, but what it was Denny never knew or cared, for his own voice screaming, "And stay out," sent the young girl scurrying down the stairs to his father. It was typical of the man that he merely commiserated with a girl, agreed with her on the urgency of some sort of discipline for his son, and then settling back to his pipe and his manuscript, dismissed the matter from his mind. The following day, Denny told the girl that henceforth she was not to enter his room, neither to make the bed nor to clean. "We shall see about that," she said, "though it would be a pleasure such as I never hope for this side of heaven, were I never to enter that horrid-smelling room again." Again his father was approached, and this time he reluctantly called his son to him. "Ethel tells me something about you not wanting her to go into your room," he said, peering over his glasses. "I'd rather she didn't, father," Denny replied, humble as pie. "You see, she doesn't understand about caterpillars and cocoons and things, and she messes everything up. But who will see to the making of your bed and dusting and such?" "I will," asserted Denny. "There's no reason why, if I don't want anyone to go into my room, I shouldn't have to make up for it somehow, like making my own bed and clearing up.
Spoken like a soldier, son, the father said. I know the way you feel, and if you're willing to pay the price and responsibility, I see no reason why you shouldn't have your wish. But, and he pointed a paper knife of walrus tusk at the boy, if it isn't kept neat and tidy, we'll have to rescind the privilege. Remember that. His father, grateful that the interview had not been as tedious as he had anticipated, told his son he could go. From then on, Denny always kept the key to his room in his pocket. Because caterpillars ceased to eat prior to their chrysalis stage, and Denny's caterpillar refused to eat whatever assortment of leaves he tried to tempt it with, Denny knew that it had definitely been preparing to cocoon when he had plucked it from the sassafras branch. It was very restless, almost convulsive now, and within the lamp chimney it humped itself aimlessly from twig to twig, its scaly little claws searching for something to settle upon. After a day of such meanderings, the caterpillar settled upon a particular crotch of the twigs and commenced to spin its cocoon. By the end of the 24 hours, the silken alembic was complete. Although there was now nothing for Denny to observe, he still squatted for hours on end staring at the cocoon that hung like some parasitic growth from the sassafras twig. His concentration upon the shape was so great, as he sat hunched over it, that his eyes seemed to tear the silken shroud apart and to be intimately exploring the secret that was taking place within. Now Denny spent less and less of the days out in the open searching for the more common types of chrysalid with which he was acquainted. Such were for him as garnets would be to a connoisseur of emeralds. His lean, tan face became puffy, and the palms of his hands were pale and moist. The winter months dragged on, and Denny was as listlessly impatient as what was inside the cocoon. His room was cold and airless, for a constant low temperature must be kept if the cocoon was to lie dormant until spring. His bed was seldom made, and the floor was thick with dust and mud. Once a week the girl left the room and dustpan along with the clean sheets outside his door, but Denny took only the sheets into his room, where they would collect into a stack on the floor for weeks at a time. His father took no notice of his condition other than to write a postscript to what was otherwise a legal and splenetic letter to his wife, that their son looked piqued, and upon receiving an apprehensive reply, he casually asked Denny if he was feeling all right. The boy's affirmatives, though noncommittal, answer seemed to satisfy him, and dropping a card to his wife to the effect that their son professed to be in sound health, he considered himself released from any further responsibility. When April was about gone, Denny moved his treasure close to the window, where the sun would induce the dormant thing within it into life. In a few days Denny was sure that it was struggling for release, for the cocoon seemed to dance up and down idiotically upon its thread. All that night he kept vigil, his red and swollen eyes focused on the cocoon as upon some hypnotic object. His father ate breakfast alone, and by 9 o'clock showed enough concern to send the servant girl up to see if everything was all right. She hurried back to report that his son was at least still alive, enough to be rude to her. The father mumbled something in reply about the boy's mother having shirked her responsibilities. The girl said that if it pleased him, she would like to give notice. She was very willing to enumerate the reasons why, but the man dismissed her casually with a request that she stay until she found someone to take her place. At 10, Denny was positive that the cocoon was about to break. By 10:30, there was no longer any doubt in his mind. Somewhat between 11, the eclosion took place. There was a convulsive movement inside, and the cocoon opened at the top with a faint rustle of silk. The feathery antenna and the two forelegs issued forth, the legs clutching the cocoon in order to hoist the body through the narrow aperture. The furry and distended abdomen, upon which were hinged the crumpled wings, was drawn out with effort. Immediately the creature commenced awkwardly to climb the twig from which the cocoon was suspended. Then he watched the procedure in a trance. Having gained the tip of the branch and unable to proceed further, the insect rested, its wings hanging moist and hairy from its bloated body. The abdomen, with each pulsation, shrank visibly and gradually, very gradually, the antennae unfurled, and the wings expanded, with the juices pumped into them from the body. Within an hour, the metamorphosis of many months was complete. The beast, its wings still slightly damp, though fully spread, fluttered gently before the eyes of the boy. Though escaped from its cocoon, it lay imprisoned still behind the glass. Then his pallor was suddenly flushed. He grasped the lamp chimney as if he could hold the insect to him. This was his miracle, his alone. He watched with a possessive awe as a creature flexed its wings, although it was still too weak to attempt flight. Surely this specimen before him was unique. The wings were easily 10 inches across, and their color was so subtly graduated that it was impossible to say where black turned to purple, and purple to green, and green back to black. The only definite delineations were a crab-like simulacrum centered on each hind wing and upon each forewing, the imitation of an open mouth with teeth bared. Both the crabs and the mouths were chalked in white and vermilion. By noon, Denny was hungry, yet so overcome with nervous exhaustion that he almost decided to forgo the midday meal, aware, however, that an absence from two meals running would surely precipitate an intrusion by his father, with a servant girl as proxy. He reluctantly left the room and went downstairs to face his father over luncheon. Despite his compliance, the father was immediately aware of the transformation of his son. "Spring seems to have put new life into the lad," he said, turning over the page of a book. "You're like your mother in that respect, and in that respect only, thank God. She never did so well in cold weather." It was the first time he had mentioned the mother to the son since he had been forced to explain her departure obliquely some 5 years before. The boy was shocked. But as the opportunity had arisen, he hastily decided to follow up the mention of his mother. It was unseemly that he should disclose any sentiment, so he hesitated and calculated before putting his question. "Why doesn't she write or send me presents?" he asked. His father's pause made him almost unbearably aware of the man's chagrin in having opened the subject. He didn't look up at the boy as he answered. "Because legally she is not allowed to." The remainder of the meal was passed in silent and mutual embarrassment. Denny returned to his room as soon as he could respectfully quit the table, and while unlocking the door, for an awful moment the possibility that the moth might have escaped, might never really have been there, scorched Denny's mind. But it was there, almost as he had left it, only now it had changed its position, the spread of its wings being nearly horizontal, and in this position Denny realized that the lamp chimney was too narrow to allow it free movement. There was no receptacle in the room any larger, and in Denny's mind there paraded the various jars, the vases, and other vessels in the house that had from time to time in the past served as enclosures for his specimens. None of them was large enough. Without sufficient room, the moth, as soon as it attempted flight, would in no time at all damage its wings. In a kind of frenzy, Denny racked his brains for the memory of some container that would satisfy his need. Like a ferret, his thoughts suddenly pounced on what had eluded them. In his father's room, a huge crystal tobacco jar with a lid of repoussé silver stood on an ebony tabouret beneath the smirking head of a tiger. There was no time to lose, for within 5 hours after emerging from the cocoon, a moth will try its wings in flight. Breathlessly, Denny bounded down the stairs and for a moment only hesitated before he knocked upon his father's door. "Yes?" his father asked querulously, and Denny turned the knob and walked in. "Father," he began, but he had not as yet caught his breath. Speak up, boy, and stop shaking. Why, even confronted by Rogue Elephant, I never shook so. I want to borrow something, the boy managed to stammer. Be more explicit, be more explicit. What do you want? A ticket to Fall River? $100 bill. A dose of Ipecac. The last would seem the most logical to judge from your looks. Hating his father, as he had never hated him before, the boy spoke up. I want to borrow your tobacco jar. Which one? The father parried. The elephant foot the president gave me? The Benares brass? The Dutch pottery one? The music box? The boy could bear his bantering no longer. I want that one. And he pointed directly which stood half full of tobacco. What for? His father asked. The boy's bravura was suddenly extinguished. Speak up. If you make an extraordinary request, you must be ready to back it up with a motive. I want it for a specimen. What's wrong with all the containers you have, already appropriated from the kitchen, pantry, and parlor? Denny would not say they were not big enough. It might arouse sufficient interest within his father, so that he would insist on seeing for himself what this monster was. Denny had a vision of his father grabbing the moth and hastening to impale it upon the sturdy wall, adding it to his other conquests. They won't do, Denny said. Why won't they do? They just won't. Be explicit, his father thundered at him. I want to put some stuff in it that won't fit in the others. You will stand where you are without moving until you can tell me what you mean by stuff. His father laid down his glasses and settled back in his chair to underscore the fact that he was prepared to wait all day if need be. Chrysalids and dirt and sticks and food for them, the boy mumbled. The man stared at Denny as if he were an animal he had at bay. You intend to put that filth into that jar? Denny made no answer. His father continued. Are you by any chance aware that that jar was a gift from the Maharana of Udaipur? Have you any faintest conception of its intrinsic value aside from the sentimental one? And can you see from where you stand that besides any other objections I might have, the jar is being employed for what it was intended for? And if for one moment you think I'm going to remove my best tobacco from my best jar so that you can use it for a worm bowl, you are, my lad, very much mistaken. The man waited for the effect of his speech and then added, Go and ask Ethel for a crock. It was useless for Denny to attempt to explain that he wouldn't be able to see through a crock. Without a word, he turned and walked out of the room, leaving the door open behind him. His father called him back, but he paid no mind. As he reached the second landing, Denny heard the door slam downstairs. A half hour had been wasted, and as he had been sure it would, the moth, having gained control over itself, was in the first struggles of flight. There was only one thing to do. Denny went to the corner where he kept his equipment. Returning, he lifted the lid from the lamp chimney and reached inside with his forceps. He clenched the moth with a certain brutality, though he took pains to avoid injury to its wing. Lifting it out, the beauty of so few hours, Denny once again felt his omnipotence. Without hesitation, he plunged the moth into the cyanide jar and screwed down the lid. The wings beat frantically with the effort that would have carried the moth on its first flight through the spring air. Breathless, Denny watched for fear the wings would be injured. The dusty abdomen throbbed faster and faster. The antennae twitched from side to side with a spasm. The abdomen formed a curve to meet the thorax. The eyes, still bearing the unenlightened glaze of birth, turned suddenly into the unknowing glaze of death. But in the moment that they turned, Denny thought he saw a distorted image gleaming on their black china surfaces, as if in that instant the moth had stored his image in its memory. Denny unscrewed the cap, plucked out the moth, and pierced the body with a pin from the black paper packet. He pinned the moth to the wall at the foot of his bed. He gave it a place of honor, centering it upon a yellow willow tree. From his bed he could see it first thing in the morning, and last thing at night. A few days and nights passed, and Denny, though still on edge, felt somewhat as a hero, must returning from a labor. The untimely death of the moth had perhaps been fortuitous, because now in its death the creature was irrevocably his. The meadows were already filled with cabbage butterflies, and Denny would go out with his net and catch them. But they were too common to preserve, and so having captured them, he would reach his hand into the net and squash them, wiping the mess in his palm off on the grass. It was less than a week after the death of the moth when Denny was awakened in the night by a persistent beating on his window pane. He jumped from bed, switched on the light, and peered outside. With the light on, he could see nothing, and whatever it had been was gone. Realizing that through the light made anything outside invisible to him, it would also act as a lure to whatever had tried to come in, he went back to bed, leaving the light on and the window open. He tried to stay awake, but soon fell back into sleep. In the morning, he looked about the room, but there was no sign of anything having entered. It must have been a June bug, or possibly a Luna moth, though it had sounded too heavy for one, thought Denny. He went over to look at the moth on the wall, a morning ritual with him. Although he could not be sure, the dust of one wing seemed to be smudged, and the oily stain from the body had soaked into the wallpaper considerably since the day before. He put his face close to the insect to inspect it more fully. Instinctively he drew back. The odor was unbearable. The following night, Denny left his window wide open, and shortly before midnight, he was awakened by a beating of wings upon his face. Terrified and not fully conscious, he hid out with his open hands. He touched something, and it wasn't pleasant. It was yielding and at the same time viscid, and something scratched against the palm of his hand like a tiny spur or horn. Leaping from bed, Denny switched on the light. There was nothing in the room. It must have been a bat, and the distasteful thought made him shudder. Whatever it had been, it left a stench behind, not unlike the stench of the spot on the wall. Then he slammed the window shut and went back to bed and tried to sleep. In the morning, his red-rimmed eyes, inspecting the moth, plainly saw that not only were the wings smudged, but that the simulacra of crabs and mouths upon the wings seemed to have grown more definite. The oily spot had spread still further, and the smell was stronger. That night, Denny slept with his window closed, but in his dreams he was beset by horned and squashy things that pounded his flesh with their fragile wings, and awakening in fright, he heard the same sound as he had heard the previous night, something beating against the window pane. All night it beat against the closed window, and Denny lay rigid and sleepless in his bed, and the smell within the room grew into something almost tangible. At dawn, Denny rose and forced himself to look at the moth. He held his nose as he did so, and with horror he saw that the stain on the paper and the crabs and the mouse, which now not only seemed more definite, but also considerably enlarged. For the first time in months, Denny left his room and did not return to it until it was his bedtime. Even that hour he contrived to postpone a little by asking his father to read to him. It was the lesser of two evils. The stench in the room was such that although Denny dared not leave the window open, he was forced to leave the door from the landing into his room ajar. What was left of the light in the hall below, after it had wormed its way up and around the stairs, crawled exhaustedly into the room. For some perverse reason, it shone almost brightly upon the wall where the moth was transfixed. From his bed, Denny could not take his eyes off it. Though they made no progress, the two crabs on the hind wings appeared to be attempting to climb up into the two mouths on the fore wings. The mouth seemed to be very open and ready for them. That night, no sooner had the beating of wings upon the window awakened Denny than it abruptly ceased. The light downstairs was out, and the room was now in darkness. Curling himself up into a ball and pulling the sheet over his head, Denny at length went off to sleep. Sometime shortly afterwards, something came through the door and half crawled and half fluttered to the bed. Denny awoke with a scream, but it was too muffled for either his father or Ethel to hear, because what caused him to scream had wormed its way beneath his sheet and was nesting like a sticky pulp upon Denny's mouth. Floundering like a drowning person, the boy threw back the covers and managed to dislodge whatever had been upon his mouth. When he dared to, he reached out and turned on the light. There was nothing in the room, but upon his sheets there were smudges of glistening dust, almost black, almost purple, almost green, but not quite any of them. Denny went to breakfast without looking at the moth. "No wonder you look ghastly," his father said to him. "If the smell in this house is half of what it must be in your room, it's a wonder you're not suffocated. What are you running up there? A potter's field for Lepidoptera? I'll give you until noon to get them out." All day Denny left the window of his room wide open. It was the 1st of May, and the sun was bright. As a sop to his father, he brought down a box of duplicate specimens. He showed them to his father before disposing of them. "Oh," said his father, "dump them far away from the house." That night Denny went to bed with both the one door and the window locked tight in spite of the smell. The moon was bright and shone all night unimpaired upon the wall. Denny could not keep his eyes off the moth. By now, both crabs and mouths were nearly as large as the wing themselves, and the crabs were moving. Denny could swear. They appeared in relief, perhaps through some trick of chiaroscuro induced by the moonlight upon the dusty white and red markings. The claws seemed upon the verge of attacking the mouths, or were the so terribly white teeth of the mouths waiting to clamp down upon the crabs? Denny shuddered and closed his eyes. Sleep came eventually, only to be broken in upon by the beating of wings against the window pane. And no sooner had that ceased, and Denny become less rigid, than the thing was at the door, beating urgently as though it must be let in. The only relief from the tap-tapping was an occasional more solid thud against the panel of the door. It was, Denny guessed, caused by the soft and fleshy body of the thing. If he survived the night, Denny vowed he would destroy the thing upon the wall, or better than losing it entirely, he would give it to his father, and he in turn would present it to some museum in Denny's name. Denny for a moment was able to forget the persistent rapping, which had now returned to the window, for in his mind he saw a glass case with a moth in it and a little card below upon which was printed, "Unique specimen, Lepidoptera, gift of Mr. Denny Longwood, age 12. All through the night, first at the window, then at the door, the beating of the wings continued, relieved only by the occasional plop of the soft, heavy body. Though having dozed for only an hour or two, with the bright light of day, Denny felt the decision of the night before indefensible. The moth smell, that was undeniable. The matter of the crab and mouth-like marking, seeming to expand and become more intense in their color, could probably be explained by somebody who knew about such things. As for the beating against the window and the door, it was probably, as he had first surmised, a bat, or if need be, two bats. The moth on the wall was dead, was his. He had hatched it, and he knew the limitations of a moth dead or alive. He looked at it. The stain had spread so that now its diameter was as great as the spread of the wings. It was no longer exactly a stain, either. It looked as if a spoonful of dirty cereal had adhered to the wall. It was just about the color of mush. "It will stop in time, like the others, just as soon as the abdomen dries up," thought Denny. At breakfast, his father remarked that the smell as yet hadn't left the house, that it was in fact stronger, if anything. Denny admitted it might take a day or two more before it was completely gone. Before the meal was over, his father told Denny that he was looking so badly that he had better see Dr. Phipps. "How much do you weigh?" he asked. Denny didn't know. "You look," his father said, "all dried up, like one of those poupées you had upstairs." the moon shone bright against the night. In spite of his logic of the morning, Denny felt sure that the movement of the white and vermilion crabs up to the white teeth and vermilion lips was more than just hallucination, and the beating of the wings started at the window again, then at the door, then back to the window, and in a way worse than the plop now and then of the body against the barrier. Though he tried to rise and look out, when it was at the window, his limbs could not obey him. Hopelessly, his eyes turned to the wall again. The crab-like spots clicked their tiny claws together each time the wings struck against the window pane, and each time the plump, squashy body went plop, the teeth snapped together between the thin-lipped mouths. All at once, the stench within the room became nauseating. There was nothing for Denny to do but make for the door while whatever it was still pounded at the window. As much as he feared and hated him, his father's cynical disbelief was to be preferred to this terror. Denny refrained from switching on the light for fear that it would reveal his movements to the thing outside. Halfway across the room and shivering, he involuntarily turned his head, and for a moment his feverish eyes saw what was outside before it disappeared. Denny rushed for the door and unlocked it, but as he twisted the knob, something beat against the other side of the door, pushing it open before Denny could shut the door against it. When luncheon was over, Ethel was sent upstairs to see what had happened. She was so hysterical when she came down that Denny's father went up to see for himself. Denny lay in his pajamas on the floor just inside the door. The skin of his lonely and somewhat arrogant face was marred by the marks of something pincer-like, and from his nose, ears, eyes, and mouth, a network of viscid filaments stretched across his face and to the floor, as though something had tried to bind his head up in them. His father had some trouble in lifting him up because the threads adhered so stubbornly to the nap of the blue carpet. The body was feather-light in the father's arms. The thought that the boy had certainly been underweight passed inanely through his father's mind. As he carried his son out, his eyes fell upon a spot on the wall at the foot of the bed. The pattern of a willow tree was completely obliterated by a creeping growth that looked like fungus. Still carrying his son, the man crossed over to it. A pin protruded from its center, and it was from the spot Mr. Longwood could tell that the terrible smell came.